Hey, this is Eric Fossum, inventor of the modern CMOS image sensor and professor of engineering at Dartmouth. You're listening to the Petapixel Photography Podcast with Sharky James. Enjoy!
Welcome to the Petapixel Photography Podcast, Episode 12. Retail giant B&H gets slammed with strong accusations. In this episode, B&H workers revolt, and we tell you why. Canon releases another mirrorless camera. But does this one miss the mark? Is Lightroom 6.2 really 600% slower than the competition? Incredible breakthroughs in sensor technology may be on the horizon. We have a special travel segment from Matt Granger. And Zeiss releases a new wide-angle lens. All that and more in episode 12 of the Petapixel Photography Podcast. Thank you so much, Mr. Fossum, for opening the show. It is truly an honor, and you've had an incredible impact on an industry that we all love. And who knows where photography would be without the CMOS sensor. So thank you so much. And I'd like to thank you all for joining us here in episode 12 of the Petapixel Photography Podcast. We appreciate you all so much, and thank you for subscribing, rating, and reviewing us in iTunes or wherever else you listen to us. Okay, with that, I'm your host, Sharky James. Let's hit it. If you've ever been to B&H in New York City, you know that it's Disneyland for photographers. Chances are you're leaving with less dollars than you arrived with, and with some pretty cool gear. Like Adorama, it's one of the biggest retailers in the photography world. But unlike them, B&H is at the center of a controversy right now, after nearly 200 workers launched a campaign to unionize this week. The workers are alleging racial discrimination, wage theft, and unsafe working conditions inside the photo retail giant's Brooklyn, New York warehouse. On Tuesday, October 13, 2015, Al Jazeera America published a detailed report outlining various complaints by B&H warehouse workers. Among the alleged abuses documented were one man's account of pulling 13-hour shifts at the warehouse and injuring his spine in an accident, which he attributes to the lack of proper training there. Others include allegations of not providing proper safety equipment due to cost, damaged health due to working near dust and fiberglass/asbestos insulation, and more. According to the news organization, B&H has faced multiple discrimination lawsuits over the years. They settled one for $4.3 million in 2007 by Latino workers, another in 2009 by female workers, and a third in 2011 by two Latino workers. Video posted online shows a large group of employees who occupied B&H's retail store this week chanting for justice. That was definitely not helpful to the retail giant. This past Sunday, October 11, 2015, unhappy B&H workers launched a campaign with Laundry Workers Center and the United Steelworkers to unionize. We reached out to B&H, but they declined our request to comment on this matter, and we'll keep you guys updated as this story develops. If you've been listening to this and my old photography podcast, you know that I've given Canon and Nikon their lumps for seemingly not taking the mirrorless market very seriously. And that's as evidenced by sales figures and the fact that most of us have yet to meet anyone with a Canon or Nikon mirrorless camera. Yeah, that's not a good thing for them. Now, while I don't think they're going to set the world on fire with this, it's nice to see that Canon appears, keyword there, to be making an effort to try to compete a little bit more against the likes of Sony, Panasonic, Fujifilm, and the others. The more advanced Canon M3 makes its debut later in October 2015, and now they've announced a baby brother to that camera called the Canon EOS M10. This more entry-level body is clearly targeted at the social media generation, as Canon points out that it shoots, quote, sharp images that are sure to draw likes, end quote. Yeah. So there's that. It has a more compact design, features a retractable EFM 15-45mm f3.5-6.3 IS STM kit lens, and Canon is touting it as being perfect for shooting, quote, selfie moments, end quote. And that's thanks to its 3-inch 1.04 million dot touchscreen LCD, which tilts up 180 degrees facing forward so you can make sure that you're in the frame. This camera features an 18-megapixel APS-C CMOS sensor with an ISO range of 100 to 12,800 and includes a fast DIGIC 6 image processor with their hybrid CMOS AF Mark II rapid autofocus system that's capable of shooting up to 4.6 shots per second. It'll shoot 1080p video at 24 or 30 frames per second has a built-in flash, Wi-Fi and NFC wireless connectivity, of course, and you can have your choice of black or white in November 2015 for $600 US with the kit lens. If you're interested in a gray version of this camera, you can get that, but only through Canon's online store. And if you're just interested in the lens, that'll go for $300 US. So the camera is basically $300, and they're touting it as a great camera for selfies. I just don't get it. And I'm going to go on record as saying that this camera won't be a massive seller, especially to the selfie crowd that they're targeting this at. If they're interested in shooting selfies and have $600 to spend, I'm thinking they're going to upgrade their smartphone. If you're available for an upgrade, that's usually about $200 for an iPhone. For $600, you can buy one outright without a contract. User Fullstop on our website said, quote, "It's just, what are they doing, man? Why can't they just try to make the best camera out there?" End quote. I'm in full agreement with that, and many others on the site had similar comments as well. You know, I could very well be wrong, and that's been known to happen, but I think this is another swing and a miss for Canon in the mirrorless game. I really don't think they get it. I truly believe that they think they're too big to fail, and then they can throw stuff at the wall and see what sticks. And guess what? Nothing is sticking lately. Nothing. They're losing a lot of DSLR buyers to other mirrorless manufacturers, and these goofy offerings are frankly embarrassing to them. I showed this camera to my kids, all of whom are selfie connoisseurs, of course, like every other kid, and they looked at me like I was crazy for even asking them. I got comments like, that's what my phone is for. Canon clearly doesn't understand that most people are not interested in buying a camera for shooting selfies. They have one in their pocket. It's called a smartphone, and it does a great job of it. Who's going to buy this camera to shoot selfies and then use an app to connect it to their phone and then put it on social media when you can just ditch the camera altogether and just go with your phone? It's much, much faster and easier, and then you'll have $600 less worth of stuff to carry around, or $600 more to go buy something actually useful to you. When it comes to mirrorless, Canon just doesn't get it, and Nikon doesn't as well, at all. I say give up or put forth cameras that people actually want. They're clearly not surveying their customers, clearly, because who's asking for a camera like this? Very few people, in my opinion, are going to go for the EOS M10. Come on, guys, it is just embarrassing. Put out cameras that people actually want, and you'll actually sell some. The sales figures do not lie. We'll keep you guys updated. At least they're trying to do something. For the longest time, you couldn't even get a Canon mirrorless camera in the United States. And now you can. So there's that. So hopefully that is a step in the right direction for them. But this camera, not so much, I'm thinking. To invent one amazing thing, that's rare. To do it a second time, that's just amazing. But it looks like the inventor of the CMOS sensor is working on something that would be a massive leap forward in sensor technology. Massive doesn't even do it justice, though. PHYS.org, that's PHYS.org, reports that research spearheaded by Dartmouth professor Eric Fossum, who invented the CMOS sensor back in 1993, is working on building a new type of sensor which packs a billion pixels onto a chip no larger than the sensors in today's cameras. And what's even more astonishing, each of those pixels are designed to detect single photons. That is just amazing. Let that sink in for a second. Those are photons which are lonely on Friday nights and have yet to find love. Wait, no, I'm pretty sure that's wrong. Right? Yeah. Photons aren't swiping right on Tinder. All right, let's get serious here. Now, how it currently works, according to the inventor, is that photons are collected for, quote, "a predetermined amount of time in a silicon rain bucket determined by physical size and capacity of that silicon pixel," end quote. But in this new technology, the Quanta Image Sensor, or QIS, the goal is to, quote, "count every pixel that strikes the image sensor and provide resolution of 1 billion or more specialized photo elements called jots per sensor," end quote. Now, we're not going to get more deep into the woods here, lest our heads explode, right? But basically, these new sensors would pretty much allow you to shoot at any ISO with ease and would open the door for high-speed photography at a much, much cheaper cost than it does now. Those high-speed cameras are incredibly expensive. So being able to do this in the future in your camera, amazing. Remember, it takes an incredible amount of light for high-speed photography also. Test this out with your smartphone. If you shoot at 240 frames per second in your home, you'll notice that it is crazy dark. It is using a really, really high shutter speed. And remember, with a higher shutter speed, you're allowing in less light. So you need more light to have a good image. With these new sensors that they're working on, that would get rid of that problem altogether. And that's pretty darn cool. Now, sadly, we won't see these sensors in our cameras for what could be up to a decade or so from now. There's a lot of work that needs to be done to make this a reality. But think about how bright the future is, no pun intended, if we have innovations like this that are coming. In the meantime, though, we're going to have to rely on innovations like Canon's mirrorless selfie camera. Yeah, no. Another amazing, influential photographer has passed. This time, it was Hilla Becher, whom you're likely familiar with if you've had formal training in photography, especially at a university. Along with her husband, Bernd, Becher founded what's known as the Becher School in photography, and the couple's black and white industrial photos of Germany, known as typologies, influenced a generation of photographers. Their photography of industrial machines and architecture in Germany, captured in a stark, emotionless, and plain manner, forced the viewers to pay close attention to design and details. They capture their well-known images with an 8x10 format camera, and the resulting images have not only been studied for decades in textbooks, they've been exhibited in grids in some of the most prominent galleries and museums in the world. The great Hilla Becher, gone at age 81. Okay, it's been a bad week for the folks on Adobe's Lightroom team. First, the 6.2 release of the popular photo management and editing software caused computers of many users to crash over and over again, becoming virtually unusable. And now, according to a test by Jim Harmer of Improved Photography, the latest version is about 600% slower than its competitors. Comparing it to Capture One, Photo Mechanic, and Apple's new Photos app, Harmer says that Lightroom has, quote, dramatically poorer performance, end quote. To do his test, he took 97 raw photos shot with his Fuji X-T1 and imported the photos, which were on his hard drive, into each of those programs. Surprisingly, Apple's Photos was the fastest, with a full import of those images taking just 9 seconds. Photo Mechanic, which has long been useful to photojournalists and anyone wanting to get through their photos very quickly, took slightly longer at just 12 seconds. Capture One was more than double at 25 seconds, which is still very reasonable, mind you, and it took 114 seconds to build full previews. So basically, under 2 minutes. No big deal. But finally, Lightroom took 190 seconds to import the photos and a whopping 685 seconds to build full previews. That's nearly 11 and a half minutes, folks. That is ridiculous. Now remember, Adobe Photoshop Lightroom is the go-to for a lot of people now, especially since Apple's Aperture is long gone. And many of us count on Lightroom to get through photos quickly so we can get on with our lives, right? And this is very, very disappointing, the direction that Lightroom is going. And I think we've all seen it. I love Lightroom, but they need to speed this darn thing up. Well, for Harmer, the honeymoon is over, as he says, quote, "The speed of Lightroom has just come down to a crashing halt, just slowly, progressively over the last 2 years, and I'm taking a really hard look at alternatives to Lightroom now." And you know what? I don't disagree with Jim at all. I've got Apple's latest and greatest 27-inch 5K Retina iMac, which cost a lot of money, and it's maxed out with all the RAM that you can put in that darn thing, and an SSD drive, which is supposed to be incredibly fast. And I too have noticed that Lightroom seems to keep getting slower and slower, and it doesn't make sense. With an incredibly fast computer setup like this, I shouldn't have to be waiting minutes to get through photos. It's just so frustrating. I don't know if it's bloated code or what, but it's 2015 now. This shouldn't be happening. You know, photographers are an impatient lot. We want things now. We don't want to have to wait minutes and minutes. If it takes as much time to cook a pizza in your oven as it does to build previews in Lightroom, that's not a good thing in 2015. Waiting minutes for things to happen is so 1995. So who knows what's going to happen next with Adobe Lightroom? They're not having a really good time over there. I like those guys. They're great guys. They make a great product, but it's gotten slower and slower. And clearly, if they're going to win back the trust of photographers around the world, they're going to have to do something, and quick. But it takes quite a while to do a complete rewrite of software. And that might be what they're just going to have to do. It might be a year away. I don't know. But they need to come out with Lightroom that is completely streamlined and a lot quicker on today's computers. It shouldn't be getting slower. If anything, it should be getting faster. Performance is key. As I said in the last episode, if you've got mission-critical stuff that needs to get done, let's say you've shot a few weddings and you need to get those photos edited and off to your clients, don't upgrade Lightroom or your system software or anything. Wait till you have 3 to 5 days off or so and then do that. That's the time when you want to do software updates. Wait till you're in the clear, then do it. All right, we'll keep you guys updated here and see what's happening with Lightroom. Hopefully there's no more bugs, no more stories coming out of Adobe on this, and everyone will be back to business. If you're a Flickr user, and there are millions of you out there, you may be happy to hear that the photo sharing service has announced that they're making videos downloadable in the same way that photos are. It's about time, right? The Yahoo-owned company says, quote, "We're excited to announce that your friends, family, followers, and fans can now download your shared videos the same way they would with your shared photos. As with photos, you control who can download your videos." End quote. Wait, aren't followers and fans kind of the same thing? I don't know. I don't have either. So log into your Flickr account, hit your account preferences, and have a look at what your download permission settings are set to. If you don't have a Flickr account, consider getting one. It's still a great service, and they've done a lot to improve it in the past year or so. They even brought the pro features back. It's a good way to show off your photos. They still have really, really great raging communities over on Flickr. Same thing with 500px. It seems like every episode that we're reporting on someone unveiling new lenses in Sony E-mount. Now, I'm a Sony fanboy, I readily admit that, but there's no bias here. Lens makers see the writing on the wall and the numbers don't lie. Sony is outselling everyone else in the mirrorless market, and if you're smart, you release E-mount glass. If you're not, you get Kodak, perhaps. For the kids, that was a company that apparently didn't see the writing on the wall or chose to ignore it. RIP Kodak. Anyhow, Zeiss just announced its new Loxia 21mm f2.8 wide-angle lens for Sony E-mount cameras. In other words, not the A77, A99, etc. We're talking the A6000, A7S, A7R, those kind. While it's designed for full-frame Sony E-mount bodies, it can also be used on crop sensor bodies from Sony, like the A6000 and the NEX models as well. Aside from being great for stills, this lens, along with the existing Loxia line of lenses, is great for video due to its mechanical aperture settings and the ability to deactivate the aperture click stop for smoother transitions. EXIF data is transmitted between the lens and the Sony E-mount bodies, of course, and you can use the optional on-screen magnification feature when manually focusing with this lens. Some of its top features are its 91-degree angle of view, a minimum focusing distance of a little less than 10 inches, a durable metal barrel, a 52mm filter thread, and special weatherproofing. But you're going to need to wait till December 2015 to pick up this bad boy, and you'll also need to part with $1,499 US. You better love wide-angle shots if you're going to drop that kind of scratch, right? Zeiss lenses are known for their quality, though, so you really can't go wrong, I'm thinking.
Hey folks, this is Matt Granger and I'm coming at you from Ulaanbaatar in Mongolia. It's my pleasure to talk to you about travel photography. It's my passion and I think it's a type of photography most of us really love. And it can be really challenging. In a way, it's like other event photography, just like a wedding. You need to practice, you need to be really well prepared, and of course, you're going to get better the more often you do it. But there's going to be certain moments where you only get the one chance to capture the special event. So you want to be prepared and ready as soon as you hit the ground. So here are some of my top tips. First of all, what should you pack? You really want to sit down before your trip and work out what it is you're going to be shooting. How do you like to shoot? Where are you going? What are the conditions that you'll be shooting in? Do your things need to be weather sealed? Are you going to need some protective cases for them? And then I strongly recommend you review the metadata from your previous trips. Go through and check which lenses and focal lengths did you actually use the most. There's no point carrying around your big, heavy 70 to 200 if you only use it two or three times on the trip. Better to leave that weight at home. I also suggest that you take along a power strip or power board in case where you're staying only has the one outlet, and you want to take enough charges so that you can charge all of your batteries in just one to two sittings. And make sure you take enough batteries and memory cards that you could miss a day or two of backing up if you run out of time. It so often happens after a long day of shooting, you're too exhausted to back up every night. Next up, how to pack. Now, you want to carry anything fragile on the plane with you. Hard luggage may give you some crush resistance, but it doesn't offer you any shake resistance. Your bags are still going to be thrown around. So if you pack your lenses in there and they're shaken and dropped and thrown about, there's a good chance that things can get damaged or your lenses could become misaligned. So you want to carry your cameras and lenses and anything fragile in carry-on, your tripod and more durable things that can all be checked in. And I strongly recommend that you pack a change of clothes with you in your carry-on. Traveling as much as I do, I've had a couple of times where my bags went missing and it's so nice to have a toothbrush and a change of pants for the following day. Something that I think a lot of photographers struggle with is how do you get all of your equipment onto the plane with the weight limits? Well, first of all, it's pretty rare that they actually weigh your carry-on luggage, but if as you're lining up you notice that they are weighing people's carry-on, then step out of the line and take all the heavy stuff that you can out of your carry-on. Put your cameras on you, put the straps on, put two or three cameras on your body. I like to wear a photography jacket and I'll put my batteries, memory cards, hard drives, extra lenses in every pocket, then walk up to the counter, let them weigh my almost empty bag, looking like I've just come from the jungle on a year-long photographic assignment with all these cameras and lenses hanging off me. But there's no rules about what you can have on your body, and of course they don't weigh people either. So they weigh the near empty bag and you're sweet. The other tip is carry along a laptop bag or, ladies, a handbag. They never get weighed and you can fit a lot in them. So, you know, the heaviest and smallest things, instead of being in check-in, as long as they're allowed to be carried on, will be in there for me. Next up, let's talk about organizing your trip. So obviously, before you even book your ticket, you want to know where you're going and what it is that you're trying to, you know, see and do and photograph. So do some Google image searches in the countries you're going to. Find amazing locations and events. Maybe get in touch with the people who took them and find out where exactly this was. It's often really handy to hire a local driver. It may sound really ostentatious, but for a small fee, you can get someone who'll take you around to locations you wouldn't be able to get to otherwise, and they can often help with, you know, communicating with locals. A big thing in travel photography is go early. If you're shooting a festival or some kind of cultural event, get there before the crowds. I was recently in Bhutan and I was shooting a really remote community festival and I got there 2 hours before the scheduled start time. I was photographing the locals and the monks set everything up and I actually got invited to join in on a religious ceremony that normally even locals don't get invited to just by being there early and showing that I was interested in interacting with people. And I think that may be the biggest one for travel photography. Interact, engage, smile, show your photos, try to really build a relationship with the people. You don't want to be a ninja sneaking around collecting shots like secret artifacts that you're going to take home without really engaging with people. Even with sign language, if you can engage with people, you'll have a richer experience and you'll connect with people, which gives you access to get photos and experiences that you just otherwise wouldn't if you were standing across the yard with your 70 to 200 getting shots just because you don't want to interrupt the moment. Get in there and build some relationships. And if you are shooting some kind of festival or a cultural event that you haven't seen before, don't just go in there for a couple of minutes. Try and stay the entire day if you can. The longer you watch and shoot, you're going to start to learn the rhythms and timings. If it's a dance, you'll know when they're twisting and when they're going to jump so you can time your shots. You're going to get better shots. Of course, travel photography is like all forms of photography. The more you do it, the better you're going to get and the more you're going to refine your images. It's a big, exciting world out there, folks. Get your gear out and see as much of it as you can. Thanks for having me, Sharky, and I'll see you all soon.
In addition to the M10 mirrorless selfie camera, Canon also announced the PowerShot G5X and G9X, both premium compacts with 1-inch sensors inside. The G5X sports a high-resolution electronic viewfinder, aka an EVF, while the G9X is more slim and stylish. Both cameras pack the same 1-inch, 20.2-megapixel CMOS sensor and have an ISO range of 125 to 12,800. As for video, they both offer 1080p at 24, 30, and 60 frames per second in MP4 format, built-in Wi-Fi/NFC connectivity, of course, and it's that connectivity that makes possible these cameras' ability to use Canon's free Camera Connect app on iOS or Android for handling files and the camera remotely. They can shoot full manual exposures, shoot RAW format, and have a built-in ND filter. You know, it's that built-in ND filter that I'd like to see in more cameras. It's pretty easy to do. I don't know why more manufacturers don't put them in their cameras. The G5X has a really great high-quality EVF, a tilting touchscreen LCD, and has a 35mm equivalent zoom range of 24 to 100mm, among other features. The G9X is slim, lightweight, more stylish, if that's important to your photography, dispenses with an EVF in favor of a non-tilting LCD on the back, and has a 35mm equivalent zoom range of 28 to 85mm. Both cameras feature Canon's intelligent image stabilization system, and if you're interested in either of them, they're set to be released in November 2015, with the more capable G5X going for $800 US and the more stylish G9X coming in at $530. You can get them both in black, of course, but if you're thinking that silver with brown leather would make you a better photographer or more stylish, you can get the G9X in what they're calling retro styling. So there's that. If instant photography is your thing, and I'm talking a print rather than an image on an LCD screen here, the Lomo Instant Wide might just be for you. That's Lomo apostrophe Instant, by the way. This new camera by Lomography uses Fuji Instax Wide Instant Film and is twice the area of the Instax Mini. It features three creative shooting modes: auto for a fully automatic experience, bulb for long exposure and light painting, and fixed shutter speed for shooting in studio settings. And you can set the aperture between f8 and f22. All right, wait a second here. Who's using one of these in a studio setting? That's what I want to know. I can't see that happening very much, but options are good, I guess. And if you want to take instant Lomography photos on your Fuji Instax Wide, you can do it in the studio now. I guess that's cool. But here's what I'm sure is really cool. The lens cap doubles as a remote shutter release. So it not only protects the camera's 90mm lens from dust and scratches, but you can use it to trigger your camera. See, now that is innovation. Why can't Canon and Nikon do something like that in, say, their mirrorless offerings? There are also wide-angle, close-up, and splitzer lens attachments to shake things up if you're not entirely happy with what you're getting with that 90mm lens. If you're into flash photography, it has one. A flash, that is. And there are gel filters included. That might be exciting to someone. If this sounds like something you'd like to get, and hey, it could make a fun gift with the holidays coming up, right? They're being produced in small batches, so get on this soon, maybe. Or maybe not. They're $199 US, with $239 getting you a bigger kit with the lens attachments and the colored filters. In addition to basic black, you can get one in colors they refer to as Central Park, Portobello, and White. Okay, white is, well, white. The other two, you're just going to have to see them for yourselves. To get one, you'll need to submit your email address on the Lomography website to get in line. You know, that's a lot of trouble to get one of these darn things, right? So, you know, if you're just really, really interested in Lomography in your studio, go ahead and submit your email address on the Lomography website and get in line. Exactly. You can hear my tone with this. I don't see it happening much. But anyways, if you want one, the first batch will be released sometime in December 2015, just in time for the holidays. I'd like to thank you all for listening to episode 12 of the Petapixel Photography Podcast. And don't forget to check us out at petapixel.com/podcast for the show notes and to see what else we have for you. We would love it if you left us a voicemail question to answer here on the podcast. So head on over there, leave us a voicemail, or you can give us a call at 206-333-9308. Now, if you'd like to connect with me personally, hit me up on Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook, where I'm at LensShark, LenSShark. All right, with that, I'll see you all in episode 13. Ooh, spooky 13. Well, it's f8 and 250th of a second outside. It's time to shoot.
Please subscribe to the Petapixel Photography Podcast. My daddy is the host.